Good evening, Archbishop.
Good evening.
I have a list of questions. I don't know if I'll have time to ask all of them, so I've got questions that I'm really keen to ask you and others. We can do that if we run out of time.
My first question is one in which I'd like to draw a tenuous link between my role and yours, if I may be so bold. I spent half of my time in academia as a professor of physics, the other half the time in public life, in public engagement of science. And I've certainly found, not so much now, but I've certainly found when I began, that public life was seen somehow as dirty, not something that I should be doing, I should be focusing on my research. You started off as an academic. You were a professor of divinity at the ridiculously young age of late 20s, I think. but so as a pure academic professor of divinity, and as you've progressed in your career, you've moved more and more to public life. So my first question is this: do you feel somehow that you might be viewed by the purist theologians in academia as someone who's not sold out, because after all, you've pretty much made it big, as it were. but do they perceive the work you do in public life somehow more vulgar than the pure theory or the theology?
It's a very interesting question, but I think two things would qualify an answer there. One is that there's always been a certain coming and going between theological academics and the public life of the church, so it's not a new thing. And the other is, if you like, the other way around, that when I was an academic, I was also a working priest. So it's not been hermetically sealed compartments. I think part of the problem, and maybe you find this too, is you're in between two worlds, both of which think you belong to the other one. So there are times when, goodness only knows why, people think I sound a bit too academic in public. The Daily Mail will say, God, remember, you're not in university now. It's no good trying to see both sides of the question anymore. At the same time, on the other side, there is just a touch of that. Well, we know you're not a real scholar anymore. You have to say these absurdly simplistic things in public. So there's a bit of discomfort both of us right
now. Now, as a scientist, I'm interested to hear your views, and I'm sure you won't be surprised to know that I'm interested to hear your views on modern science. I'm a big fan of John Polkinghorne, who's probably the most famous contemporary Christian physicist. I, for instance, I'm well aware that you have no issues with Darwin's theory of natural selection. How do you and the church address creationists? And, as scientists, we are very aware and concerned about the rise of creationism. How do you address it? How do you reconcile that and convince them otherwise?
Well, one way of getting at it, I think, is just to try and clarify what Christians do and don't mean by the doctrine of creation. To me, the trouble with creationism is that it suggests not only did God make the world, he went on sort of anxiously fiddling with it. So it's not just a matter of God creating the world right at the start, but every so often God gives a little twitch to the mechanism. And that suggests to me, well, perhaps it wasn't good enough to start with. Well, it's not any great compliment to God. As I understand it, the doctrine of creation says very flatly and simply, what you need to know is that whatever is depends ultimately on God's choice and God's action. We're here because God wanted us here, as a universe, that is. And that's the thing which was quite surprising and quite new in the intellectual climate of the ancient world, in some ways. It's still, I think, an extraordinarily liberating doctrine in many ways, because it says that we are wanted, or we are invited into being. And I think you lose sight of that if you get too focused on this rather anxious picture of a God who's adjusting all the way along. Now, I think, again, you have to say about creationism, is it reading the Bible correctly? Is it understanding what kind of text the Bible is? And I think the beginning, the first couple of chapters of Genesis, again, tell us what we need to know. What is exists because God invites it into being. From the very beginning, things have gone badly wrong with the human race. And God has not yet given up on us. Now that's quite a good start. But all of that seems to me obscure by getting into, you know, ditches you ought not to be dying in, into the sort of trench warfare of creationism, intelligent design, and so forth, trying to meet scientists on their own territory when that's not actually what Genesis gives you the ammunition for.
Now, famously, certainly on TV programmes that I've seen, you've come up against Richard Dawkins, that stalwart of atheism. Mind you, love him or loathe him, he certainly brought this issue of not so much, you know, science versus faith, but I mean, one way to say, because personally I'm an atheist, I would say that, you know, he's made atheism respectable in the sense that he's put himself at some extreme militant atheism and allowed other atheists who would rather not insult those of faith more middle of the road, more cuddly atheism. I would say it used to be that, you know, atheism was rather extreme stance and it's much more sensible to be agnostic. But now that we have Richard Dawkins, it's something alien. Do you feel that it's a good thing, what he's done in terms of getting this debate out in the open to talk about faith and why, whether there were tensions between faith and rationality or faith and science?
I must say, I don't lose too much sleep over Richard Dawkins in the sense that...
I'm guessing you didn't.
In the sense that these are controversies that break the surface in intellectual life every 30 years or so. And there's usually a kind of, just as we have an astronomer world, we almost have an atheist world, don't we? We have some big public intellectual figure, Bertrand Russell or whatever, now Richard Dawkins, who is the atheist you turn to for public comment on things. And I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. The difficulty is, I think, when something gets into the bloodstream of our corporate mind through this, which keeps nagging away, well, you know, religion and science are really incompatible after all, aren't they? Some of the mud sticks. And I think that's a pity. I also think it's a pity that what I call the non-scientific bits of Richard Dawkins' worldview stick around too. And by that I mean, Richard Dawkins is not just an evolutionary biologist. He's also somebody who's advanced some highly speculative theses around that, the theory of memes and things like that, which, from a philosophical standpoint, I cannot make head or tail of. And that again gets a bit into the bloodstream. And the notion that you can simply abstract a highly successful thesis from biology and genetics, evolution, natural selection, and then apply it right across the board to solve every single problem going, I think that really is daft. That's where we ought to be concentrating our attention. But one other thing that actually I think is very important and positive about Richard Dawkins is that when he wants to be, he's a superb communicator of the excitement of science. And that big fat book of his called The Ancestor's Tale, I think is just wonderful as popular science. And he communicates not only excitement, but a sense of almost religious mystery. I rather mischievously quoted a passage from that in a Christmas sermon. So we're challenging people to spot the author. I don't think Richard would thank me for it.
On the subject of, again, this is for me as an atheist, it's an interesting question, subject of ethics and values and morality. I'm sure you've been asked this many times. To what extent do you feel that religion is necessary to set society's moral and ethical boundaries? Because, you know, I would say that, of course, I'm fully capable of having my own moral compass and I know what's right or wrong. I don't need religion to tell me what's right or wrong, of course. So what is the church's response to this?
I think it's perfectly possible, obviously, as a matter of fact, for people to have that sense of the moral compass without necessarily having religious convictions. I would, though, say that you then need to work rather hard to explain why that sense of the moral compass isn't just arbitrary or isn't just your decision, but might be rooted in something about where the universe is. And for me, what the religious dimension does is to say, the person struggling to live a good life isn't just exercising a set of individual choices. They are somehow making visible the way reality is, ultimately, of course, the way God is, God, creator and redeemer. And I always feel there's a bit of a gap somewhere. So people may make the right choices and the right philosophy of life in terms of ethics, and yet I want to say, so where is it grounded, ultimately? And it's not exactly a knockdown argument, but it does seem to me that you need some anchorage for it if it's not just to be a matter of chance preferences.
So you have a moral compass, but you don't know why.
Yeah. And for me, the moral compass, of course, is rooted in the way we are.
Now, I recently made a TV series on medieval Islam and science in medieval Islam, and I certainly encountered many Muslims who view science with suspicion. They see it as a Western, secular, even atheist construct. And so they're sort of quite suspicious of it. Sadly, one sees this in the 21st century, not just among Muslims, but among all other faiths as well. Do you have any advice for me and others who want to engage with people of faith who are suspicious of science in a way that isn't dismissive of their beliefs and faiths in the way that Dawkins would be attacked?
I think I'd probably home in on that extraordinary period in broadly Western philosophical history between, let's say, about 900 and about 1400, where Christian, Muslim, and Jewish thinkers were all of them thinking very hard and very much in dialogue with each other about the nature of God and the nature of the universe. And anyone who thinks that interfaith dialogue is a thing of the 20th and 21st century, you look at the way in which the great figures of the Middle Ages interacted, commented on each other, absorbed each other's vision. And it's all there. And one of the themes that comes through there is God is consistent. God is not just a kind of arbitrary tyrant. God is consistent. God is reasonable in the broadest possible sense. And therefore, the world God has made is a world in which you can expect consistency, rationality, some kind of coherence. And that belief for Christians, Muslims, and Jews in the Middle Ages was actually one of the things that made science possible. In the Muslim world, God made the others, in fact. Christians caught up a bit, though some of the Muslim roots actually go back further to what they had read of Syrian translations by Christians of Greek texts. And so you've got, a great intermingling. So actually, the tradition of religious philosophy is bound in with the scientific enterprise, far more than many people realize. And I'd want to say to any religious person who felt there was a kind of natural incompatibility there, well, look at the history. Look at what your faith made possible. Because it was your faith that made it possible.
I'm always interested when I read about how medieval Muslim theologians were driven to read about Aristotelian philosophy because they had to hone their arguments against the Christian and Jewish theologians who'd had a head start on them.
Yes, absolutely. And Christians, similarly, swatting up on Aristotle to capture all these arguments.
Yes.
So Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, absorbing Aristotle, very controversial stuff at the time, so that he could provide the right sort of response to Muslim thinkers like Avicenna.
Yes, and Maimonides.
And Maimonides, yes. Yes.
Yeah. You have a reputation of being quite orthodox in Christian faith, but probably radical in social faith. Not controversial, like it. but a lot of your public life, your social agenda, I think you're probably quite radical and outspoken on many issues. the strong emphasis in your life about regenerating communities and working with the poor, supporting the underprivileged. I'm aware your leadership in Drop the Debt campaign and the Jubilee 2000 campaign to remove third world debt. How is that going now? How do you feel you've had some headway, had some success in this?
One of the important things about the Jubilee 2000 campaign about international debt, I think, was that it had a clear goal about cancelling unpayable debt and a clear cut-off point. And it was possible, I suppose, to feel you've done it. You know when you've done it. We've not had a campaign quite like that since. Make Poverty History is a tremendous vision. But you know, how do I know when I've made poverty history? Is poverty over yet? Well, actually, no. When will it be? We'll know it when we see it. So one of the problems we face, I think, in public lobbying about some of these big international issues is they're too big. And it feels as if campaigning on some of these things, you won't ever get to the end of it. And people like to feel that's a sort of landmark that they can point to. So I think the important thing is to try and keep up people's morale in campaigns like this and say, well, set yourself limited targets, which is better than nothing, and don't despair because you can't change everything at once. I think this is one of the major messages that has to get across where, let's say, climate change is concerned. People think, oh, we're all doomed, so why bother? And it's important to say, yes, but you can actually make some measurable difference to the quality of life enjoyed not only in this country but in the poorest parts of the world by making certain decisions about energy use and so forth. So I think that's part of the challenge we're up against at the moment.
Do you feel it's important that you engage in these political issues, I guess? I mean, you spoke at the Copenhagen Summit
as
well. I know you've... you stated that bishops have no option but to take up the cause of the environment, not because of what the world says, but because it's inherent in your faith. As a scientist, it's very important for me to get across to the general public how science works. And so, for instance, on the issue of climate change, it's very worrying for me that the small band of climate change deniers are leaping on issues like the IPCC exaggerations about the human personality. How do you respond to climate change deniers?
With a puzzlement, really. I can see that people will want to hold us to the fact that we're dealing probabilities, not cast iron certainties. That's fine, that's fair enough. But it seems to me that on almost any analysis, we as human inhabitants of this planet have been responsible for altering the circumstances in which we live. I don't see how you can deny that. You can argue about the measure of it, you can argue about the proportion between human-generated and natural causes outside our control. But even if you were to allow a very large measure of scepticism, you might still, I would still want to say, we have environmental degradation, which impacts horribly on the most vulnerable, and we ought to do something about it. So don't get too bogged down in the science, I say, with respect. But there clearly is an issue about which something can be done. And so, to the denier, I'd say, well, if you insist on denying, okay, but can you not recognise that there is an agenda? Wherever it comes from, there's an agenda.
I think I'll keep going for another 10 minutes or so before we open up questions. I'd like to come back to the issue of faith and actually the idea of prayer, which I find quite difficult to fathom. And it's such a well-trodden argument, I know, but in a world of inhumanity, suffering after disaster, how do you continue to pray? I mean, is is your Christian faith a comfort or struggle? How do you cope with, say, Haiti?
The person who prays about Haiti isn't, I think, first and foremost saying to God, "You sort it out because I can't," but somehow trying to open their own life to enough of God's love for a difference to be made, becoming a channel in some way for a healing purpose or a restoring purpose. That can work itself out in practical ways, if you're doing something about it, giving, getting involved. If that's not possible, then the Christian makes the very bold assumption, as I think do people of other faiths, just opening your mind and heart to that somehow brings into the world something of God's action, God's freedom, that can in principle make a difference. So I think in these horrible circumstances, it's not a matter of how can anybody pray in the middle of that. People just do. They want to connect the horror of the situation with the love of God somehow. They want to be in a place where those two frames of reference overlap. The dreadfulness, the urgency of suffering, and the unchanging fact of God. There are no theories that will get you through that. But in the middle of it, amazingly, people do just this. They try to make themselves a place where that can come in. I've quoted several times in the last couple of years the really remarkable statement of Etty Hillerson, the young Jewish woman who died in Auschwitz in the 40s, and whose diaries are a fantastic source of inspiration. Not a very religious person, but as the persecution gets more serious in Amsterdam, and she realizes that she's at risk, she steps further into faith, not further away from it, because she says, somebody's got to take responsibility for God. Somebody's got to live in this world as if God were real. Somebody's got to, again, live in that overlap between the horror of the situation and the utter liberty and love of God. And that's the road she takes on. I've got to live as if that were true. And as I say, she's someone coming from a very secularized Jewish background and becoming more a person of faith as the darkness closes around her. It's an extraordinary story. That says something to me about prayer.
Now, you're close to the World Trade Center, 9/11. I know you've written on what you all encountered that day. Has the experience changed the course of your work in ministry, if at all?
It was, I suppose, the nearest I've been to death. And that in itself makes a difference, being a block away. None of us knew if we were going to get out alive. To death gives you a bit of a sense of priorities, the sort of things that do and don't matter, and you sort of look into that. And it certainly sharpened up my own personal commitment about trying to find the words and the relations of reconciliation that somehow helped to make that sort of nightmare a bit less likely. I was back there in Lower Manhattan just 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I've been back twice to the site, and it's quite hard work, and I realise when I'm back there that it has sunk in, but in ways which beyond what I've already said are quite difficult to formalise.
Now, I think it was Hans Kuhn, the controversial Swiss theologian, who said, "There'll be no peace among the nations without peace among the religions. There'll be no peace among the religions without dialogue among the religions." I know you're very much engaged in interfaith dialogue, so maybe you could tell me a little bit more about the interfaith work you're doing.
Well, it's quite a square, really, because on the one hand, there's a long-standing relationship with the Catholic Protestants and Jews. That's been part of my life for, I suppose, nearly 20 years now. And a very fruitful, engaged, sometimes quite difficult conversation there. I guess it's really in the last 7 or 8 years that dialogue with Islam has become more possible. And that works at a number of levels. It works at the international level, because I convene each year a group of about 30 leaders and scholars from across the world, Christian and Muslim, balance of people. And we have a week looking at each other's scriptures, really. We're trying to draw out general insights, not from talking generalities, but from looking at what's there. Trying to watch the other person, or listen to the other person reading their scriptures, and say, what have we got to learn? How do we understand more? So we've looked at issues around public life, around justice and law, right, religion. We've looked at slightly narrower theological questions. Who is Abraham in our traditions? What do we mean by the word prophet? And these have been very exciting, enriching conversations, which we've deliberately not sought to make particularly public. Therefore, the people involved, these are quite often fairly influential thinkers and intellectuals across the board. And I think all those involved, and it's been a fairly steady core group, would have said they come away enriched by that. At another level, the Christian Muslim Forum in this country, launched a few years ago, tries to build bridges again at grassroots level to encourage local Christian and Muslim communities to find out what they can do together, what the needs of the community they share are, what might be the priorities in community regeneration, education, whatever. And that too is an exciting project. So there's all of that, and then sometimes you try and put bits of the jigsaw together and have the three-cornered conversations with the Abrahamic faiths. And we also continue to work quite hard at developing a dialogue with Hindus in this country, which has proved a bit more complicated because there are different networks to relate to. Individuals relate to each other too easily, and so that's a challenge we work about. So there's quite a lot to be doing. And purely personally, I've for a long time been fascinated by Buddhism, especially the meditational traditions of Buddhism, and try to keep that as an interest and a concern.
And that brings us nicely to the multi-faith centre that we're hoping to have here at Surrey, which personally it's something that I know would work. I mean, I grew up in a household with a church-going Christian mother, a Shiite Muslim father. I fallen between the two schools, but nevertheless, there was never any conflict. There was always the interfaith dialogue was there in my house growing up. I know you're a patron of the project to get the multi-faith centre funded. Can you explain why?
A university is a very, very good place to model encounter and dialogue. Mm-hmm. Barely needs saying. But if encounter and dialogue are good in themselves, then universities ought to encourage them in religion as in other matters. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a hugely imaginative project, which, without compromising anyone's convictions or claims, just says, well, here is a space you can share and where it's safe to be yourself and where you've got time and space to listen to your neighbours. I think that's a wonderful idea. Well done. I think there are places around the country that try that, like St. Ethelburgers in London. I think the more of those we have, the better.
I want to show a short clip at the moment. I've got one last very brief question for you. The Simpsons. I gather that's your favourite TV programme. I'm not sure whether this is because of the various moral and ethical dilemmas they cover, or just because it's so very funny.
Of course it's because of the moral and ethical. I think it's actually actually rather encouraging that a brilliantly popular programme can take a number of quite serious human issues and make them funny and leave you with some real questions. But yes, I still sort of switch off work for half an hour and go and join the family to watch The Simpsons at 6 o'clock. My other addiction on television, it's the only other one really, is The West Wing. Because, you know, watching somebody in the public eye stagger from cowpat to cowpat. Frantic lifestyle. It reminds me of something.